Afternoon, everybody. It is a little bit, well, like 3:05, and welcome to the Rules Committee in Hearing Room E. We're still getting used to this. And it's May 18th, 2011, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on HJR 34.
Mr. Chairman, HJR 34, upon approval by the people of the November 2012 general election, it amends the Oregon Constitution to allow the Legislative Assembly to prohibit the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. Chair Olson. Chair Olson. Nice to see you down there. You've handed me this piece of power, and now you're, yeah, okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I am state representative out of the Albany area. This bill comes to you as a referral from Judiciary Committee. It has already been heard at length. Representative Garrett and I serve on Judiciary, so we've had a chance to move it down here for you. You have it now because of it being a referral to the voters. But I'm going to go through my testimony really quick with you here, and then I'll leave it with you here at this point. But no healthy parents want to think about his or her child viewing pornography, but it often happens. Some researchers have stated that the average age of exposure to pornography is down to 8 today. Before the days of the internet, children were typically between ages of 11 to 13 when they began by viewing softcore pornography found in magazines like Playboy. Today's child lives in a culture where hardcore pornography abounds. Our children are being seduced daily, and we need to bear this fact in mind whenever we have the occasion to redirect them from pornography. Clinical psychologist David Byrd from Corvallis once stated, "Sexual addiction is the fastest growing addiction in the United States. It's based in part on the fact that obtaining sexual literature, pornography, is so convenient today. It's more readily available. It is there at the click of the finger." And you got to ask yourself this question as I've dug into this even deeper, and I have a real passion for this. How do you raise a G-rated child in an X-rated world? HJR 34 is a new provision of Article 1, Section 46, which it would be of the Oregon Constitution, that prevents harm from occurring to our children. It allows the Oregon legislature the ability to create boundaries that protect our children from the harm of sexually explicit material. Article 1, Section 8 right now, the speech portion of this, our Constitution, says this: "No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right." HJR 34 adds this language to Article 1. "The Legislative Assembly may prohibit the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors in any manner consistent with the United States Constitution." This last September, the Ninth Circuit Court put Oregon between a rock and a hard spot. The court struck down ORS 167.054, furnishing sexually explicit material to a minor, and struck down half of ORS 167.057, luring a minor with the use of sexually explicit material as unconstitutionally, specifically when the material is used to arouse the person or the minor. Now, there was only 3 members in this entire building back in 07, if you remember this, that did not vote for this package, and that was House Bill 2843. Many of you have heard one of the most famous expressions made in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Potter Stewart was attempting to describe a threshold test for describing pornography in the Jacobellis versus Ohio 1964 case. "Obscenity is not protected speech under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and can therefore be censored." And this is what he said: "I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, hardcore pornography, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it." And you've heard that. Let me read the definition of the type of pornography we're talking about that are found in two mentioned statutes that Powell Bookstore and others felt was okay for children's viewing. Now, this is tough. Sexually explicit material means material containing visual images of human masturbation or sexual intercourse, genital to genital, oral to genital, anal to genital, or oral anal contact, whether between persons of the same or opposite sex or between humans and animals, or penetration of the vagina or rectum by any object other than as part of a personal hygiene practice. As you study the two statutes that were knocked out by the Ninth Circuit, you find that there are some affirmative defenses that we placed to protect parents and libraries. Oregon has failed to stay up with the times in protecting our children and thus our future. It has been said that the eyes are the windows of the soul. Boys and girls are wired entirely different. Boys respond visually. There is so much clinical research to support that statement. Even though I'm a psychologist who socializes in early education, it took having kids to make me realize that sex differences aren't just the stuff of the Brady Bunch. In fact, one study found that when 18-month-old boys and girls were shown pictures of a doll and a vehicle, for example, most of the girls opted for the doll, while the majority of the boys chose the vehicle. And while 18 months is old enough to have been influenced by stereotype gifts, research suggests that many of the differences we see are evident from birth and may even be hardwired. And that was said by Anita Sethi, PhD clinical psychologist. I want this committee to realize the urgency in moving this bill forward to the voters. It is good to be recognized as a pioneer state and support our Bill of Rights, but to ignore the efforts to protect our children from harm is a crime. And I just want to close with this, and I share this in Judiciary. A couple weeks back, before I testified in Judiciary on this, I couldn't sleep. I got up about 2 o'clock in the morning and went downstairs and jumped on the internet, and I started searching the whole issue about the history of pornography and interviews, and stumbled onto an interview with Ted Bundy that was a half hour long by Dr. James Dobson. And it was a very disturbing interview. This happened back in 1989, and he was just within hours of being electrocuted. He shared that he was somewhere between 10 to 12 years old when he was exposed to his first piece of pornography. And it happened to be a Playboy magazine that he and a friend found in a garbage can. Now, I'm not pointing the picture of what's happening here, that a Playboy just even coming close to what we're trying to do here in protecting children from what the two laws that I've described to you got knocked down. But the point being is that there is sufficient clinical evidence that boys do respond to this entirely different than what females do. And because of that, that's why we created those two laws back in 07, taking that into mind. We are in a rock and a hard spot right now, and in order for us to move forward to stay consistent with what the U.S. Constitution allows us to do, we have to have this little carve-out in Article 1. So, appreciate you listening to me on that.
Questions? Representative Garrett?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wilson. I guess my question is, since the statutes that we passed in 07 were partially upheld by the court, I wonder if you have, what statute is not there that we need to have that you're trying to make legal with this constitutional amendment? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, the first one that I mentioned to you, 167054, which is furnishing sexually explicit material, was completely struck down. The second one, the luring one, a portion of it was upheld. And I appreciate the question, because I spent weeks talking with a number of defense attorneys to try to craft an idea where I would go outside of having to go this direction. I'd ensure that in the judiciary. We were struggling, trying to find where we go, taking in consideration of all the U.S. case law that exists that drives where, you know, other states are able to go, considering where we're at because of Section 8.
So would it be your intent then that after, if we approve this and the voters approve it, that we resurrect 167054? Is that ultimately what you're trying to accomplish? Or is there a different statute that you would like to bring?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Garrett, I appreciate that question too. I think obviously there was a message that was presented by what the Ninth Circuit said to us here, even though Judge Mossman of Portland and had upheld the case, the two laws twice before. I believe that we have to sit down with a lot of the folks that were there at the table initially, because I'd spent like about 14 months working on this before the 07 session, and I think that would be wise to do.
Additional questions? Seeing none, thanks for your testimony. Looks like we have just one additional person signed up to testify, Andrea Meyer, ACLU.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. Representative Olson and I chatted prior to the hearing a few days ago, and he asked that instead of the folks who came and testified to judiciary, if I would just limit it to myself today. And I agreed. I'm providing written testimony that was submitted to the judiciary. I'm covering some other areas today, but I just wanted to note that joining us in testimony in the judiciary was the Oregon Library Association, an attorney, and then one of the plaintiffs in the case, and I have a brief statement from a compilation of her testimony, which is a brief statement which I will give afterwards. But the ACLU does oppose House Joint Resolution. And actually, I want to go back even before 2007 and probably before the chair, co-chair was here in the building, because this issue about the Oregon law related to specifically giving sexually explicit material to minors for the purposes of grooming them to sexually abuse them was arguably a gap in the law when the predator out there used that material but then was caught before he or she accomplished the ultimate sexual assault and abuse. So for 10 years, we grappled with it. In 2007, in creating the new provisions, that was covered, but it went further than that, making it a crime to provide material that contains sexually explicit conduct to a minor without this criminal intent. So we, ACLU, did sue, along with the Media Coalition, on behalf of a number of clients, including, as you heard, the lead client, Powell's Books, but also Dark Horse Comics, other bookstores across the state, the American Booksellers Foundation for Free Expression, the Planned Parenthood, Cascades A Project, and so on. The Ninth Circuit, and we only challenged a part of the law, not the whole law. The Ninth Circuit held under the First Amendment, not the Oregon more restrictive protective free expression provision, that the parts that we challenged were all unconstitutional. The part we didn't challenge is still a Class C felony, the grooming or luring provision. And I want to just clarify so it's clear for everyone. It is still a crime in Oregon to lure a minor if the person furnishes to or uses with a minor a visual representation or explicit verbal description or narrative account of sexual conduct for the purpose of inducing a minor to engage in sexual conduct. It fills the gaps of a predator being caught, and it makes it a separate crime rather than an attempt. But the law went too far, as I said, because it made material that contains sexually explicit conduct in and of itself a crime, and you cannot do that. Material containing sexually explicit conduct is not, with all due respect, always hardcore pornography. It's not even pornography or anything resembling what would envision with that term. Instead, analyzing the law under the First Amendment, the court identified a wide range of material that would fall under the definition of the Oregon law of material that has sexually explicit conduct that may or may not arouse a person, but was in no way pornography or obscenity. And a few examples because I think it's important to understand when we talk about the term sexually explicit in the statute, what that ends up including. So children's books, and the court specifically relied on this as the evidence as to why it was unconstitutional. Mommy Laid an Egg and Where Do Babies Come From? I have a picture of where do babies come from, and although it's hard to tell, what this depicts is sexual intercourse, and there's also written description. This is an appropriate age appropriate tool for those who are wanting to work with their children on that. It also held that Affected would be one of my favorite books as a young adult, Judy's Bloom Forever. A romance novel which Judge Mossman admitted that he read for purposes of this case, After Midnight, and Snow Falling on Cedars, and Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, to name a few. Simply because a portion of that material might titillate or arouse a minor. The Ninth Circuit wrote, titillation and arousal are not synonymous with abnormal or prurient sexual response. To criminalize furnishing material solely intended to titillate the reader will criminalize a broad swath of material that does not appeal to prurient interest. The court held that the statutes sweep in many works that include portions solely intended to titillate and arouse the reader, but also has serious value. The court did recognize the legislative attempt that Representative Olson referred to try to curtail, and indeed, as he mentioned, there was a work group, we participated in it, ultimately we opposed it, but the law was from thoughtful individuals attempting to move forward, and not only did the AG participate, the AG helped draft the law and it helped defend the law, but it is worth noting that the Attorney General has not been involved in seeking this constitutional referral to the voters as a tool necessary. To be clear, we don't believe HJR 34 is the roadmap. Certainly not to reviving the 2007 laws that were held unconstitutional, because even if we amend our Constitution to align with the First Amendment, those statutes that were referenced earlier were held unconstitutional under the First Amendment, not, again, as I said, Oregon Constitution. And I know these attempts... And I've worked with Representative Olson, so I want to be clear that I respect and understand where he's coming from, but these attempts do have real costs, unfortunately. And the attorney's fees in this case alone, and we settled the attorney's fees, which means we did not receive the amount we were entitled to between us and the Media Coalition, were over $200,000. So we and the role ACLU feels we serve down here is to be a cautionary on things because we'd like it to be a full employment act, but that's not why we're here. Most importantly, we believe there are sufficient Oregon laws on the books to cover this area. In addition to the luring statute that is still constitutional, I just want to note quickly the sexual offenses, rape, sodomy laws, unlawful sexual penetration, sexual abuse, online sexual corruption of a child, contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, public indecency, unlawful contact with a child, visual recording of sexual conduct of children, encouraging child sex abuse, possession of materials depicting sexually explicit conduct of a child, or an attempt of any of those crimes. The problem with an attempt to regulate minors' access to material that has sexually explicit content is that even under the First Amendment, it reaches distribution of far more material than what is hardcore pornography or obscenity. It implicates a substantially large amount of constitutionally protected speech. As noted earlier, the plaintiffs in the case were all law-abiding organizations and individuals, but they were directly implicated, and it was not a close call, and I will note, although it was the Ninth Circuit, it was not a liberal panel. Criminalizing the contents of speech without being tied to a criminal intent element is just fraught with problems. In addition, the language of the amendment is to prohibit the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors in any manner consistent with the United States Constitution. You know, there is no federal standard for furnishing sexually explicit material, and we believe this referral would raise more problems and questions than solutions. We would first of all be tying our constitutional interpretation to a federal constitutional interpretation of language that is not defined. Those words do not appear in the U.S. Constitution, which then leaves our courts, if there is a law passed, to look at federal case law to understand whether any new Oregon law would comply with the federal constitutional standard. So our courts would look to, where would they look? Do our courts turn to wherever the majority of the the U.S. Supreme Court is at any given time. It doesn't say the U.S. Supreme Court. So is it the Second Circuit, the Ninth Circuit? Is it a U.S. District Judge in Oklahoma? The U.S. Supreme Court does not take most cases, and circuits may divide and have different laws and interpretations in this area. So where does our court begin? It creates a very difficult situation. And why would we relegate our Constitution, I need to add, with constitutional protections and interpretations to the whims of case law in another state? Turning over our free expression provision to the U.S. Supreme Court does not open the door to easily restrict a minor's access to material that has sexually explicit conduct. Again, as I note, first of all, the Powell case relied on the First Amendment. But we have useful Supreme Court case law that's informative. In 1996, Congress tried, well, they did pass the Communications Decency Act to protect minors from harmful material on the Internet, specifically prohibiting knowingly transmitting obscene or indecent material to persons under age 18. And there were a number of affirmative defenses similar to the Oregon law that was held unconstitutional. That case went to the Supreme Court. By an opinion of 7-2, and the two were concurring in part, the court held in ACLU versus Reno that those provisions were unconstitutional. And there were some familiar names joining the majority, Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. The court stated that while recognizing government interest in protecting children, it does not justify a broad suppression of speech. Quote, as we have explained, the government may not reduce the adult population to only what is fit for children. And in 2010, in what I think we can all agree is a disturbing underlying issue, in State v. Stevens, the court upheld in an 8-1 opinion that the right to have crush of videos, which show women, often in stiletto heels, stepping on and killing small animals, which is apparently a sexual fetish, is constitutionally protected free speech. We do not believe Oregon's Constitution is a barrier to protecting our children. Indeed, as Representative Olson talked about, we must teach our children to provide and provide them with age-appropriate material. But our safety cannot and must not depend on censorship. It has never made the community safer. The ACLU, along with other organizations, and based on multiple votes on the issue, the majority of Oregonians agree with us that we should not weaken our free speech provision. I won't delve into the state constitutional history, but will simply mention that since 1859, it's not been amended. But I do want to touch on briefly the last 17 years of this issue and issues like this coming up before the voters, and I will be very quick. I appreciate the graciousness of the time. Each time, Oregonians have made it clear they don't want the government telling them what they read, see, and hear. Starting in 1994, Measure 19, an initiative, amended Article 1, Section 8 to add a new section requiring the term obscenity shall have the meaning also given by the United States Supreme Court, and in addition, shall also include child pornography. I want to be clear, child pornography is not allowed under the Oregon Constitution. It went down 55-45. 2 years later, the legislature referred Measure 31, again adding a new section to Article 1, Section 8 regarding obscenity. No greater protection than afforded under the U.S. Constitution. It was rejected by voters 53-47. In 26 of the 36 counties, and Representative Freeman, if I have this correctly, it was Douglas County, it was rejected, if I've got your county correct. In 2000...
I represent parts of three counties.
I didn't check all of them. I'm sorry. I'll stick with Douglas County. I'm almost done. Thank you, Representative.
I was listening.
In 2000, 4 years later, the legislative referral of Measure 87, which allowed cities and counties to zone sexually oriented businesses. I think this one's informative because I think you still hear from your constituents about adult businesses. And it was certainly promoted as child safety, neighborhood safety. There was no loss of the message when it went forward to the voters, but they rejected it 53-47. And then finally, recently in 2006, Measure 46 amended the free expression provision on campaign finance. This one's slightly different because it had a statutory companion, Measure 47, that would have implemented it. I think it's informative. As you may recall, Measure 47, the statutory one, passed. Voters said, we have a problem with campaign finance. We like that. But they rejected by 60%-40% the Article 1, Section 8 amendment. And all but one of the voter pamphlet statements against that were about free speech. Voters understand the issues, and they rejected these arguments about aligning us with the federal Constitution. We have strong laws against child abuse and sexual assault. We don't think there's any gap in light of what was upheld in the 2007 law, and we respectfully believe all legal and appropriate steps have been taken. We urge you not to refer yet another free speech amendment
weakening that provision to the Oregon voters. I appreciate the opportunity and the time. I will not read the whole thing in because it's a little bit longer, but I just want to note that Candace Morgan was a plaintiff in our case, and she was subject to this law because she's a grandmother, and often was a 21-year veteran of a library, a former chair of the American Library Association, and she felt, and indeed the court agreed, that under that statute she was subject to a challenge because despite the attempted affirmative defenses, she was a grandmother, not a parent. And I apologize to her because I will not read the rest of this in because of time, but she joins us in opposing this.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? I just one really quick question.
Absolutely.
I was thinking, and actually this question was asked basically in judiciary, dealt with the sexual educational books. If we create a statute based on the U.S. constitutional standard, would the sexual educational books be criminalized?
Chair Olson, members of the committee, if we created a statute, the reason I'm pausing is because, I mean, I don't know under the terminology where we would look to determine. And if you do a statute similar to what was written that gets outside the scope of the criminal intent, but simply that minors have access, I think you've got a problem. Here's where I think, you know, absent the predators...
Just do it really quick.
Right. Absent the predators, you know who gives probably this kind of material to kids? It's their siblings and their friends are sharing this material, or it's through the Internet, which is the Congress has tried to regulate. It's sharing without the criminal intent, and I think it actually that's how kids, unfortunately, see this. Is not by the predators that we've now restricted.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on HGR 34, and I am going to, colleagues, move to the education bills on the backside of our agenda. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 800.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Cox is going to staff that for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 800 removes outdated evaluations, reports, reporting requirements, filings, preparations, and distribution of education laws, policies, curriculum requirements, assessments, certifications, and additional mandates from education statutes. We have the fiscal statement and no revenue impact. We have -1 amendments, which Representative Johnson introduced last week, and we have -2 amendments, which Representative Huffman is going to address today.
Yeah, Representative Huffman, if you want to come up and share what -2s do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, John Huffman, State Rep for District 59. And the -2 amendment would be incorporating the provisions of House Bill 3359 into Senate Bill 800. House Bill 3359 is a small rural schools bill that would remove the sunset on the funding, which is an ADMW funding formula allowing foreign exchange students to go to 5 small rural boarding schools in Burnt River, Ukiah, Paisley, Mitchell, and Spray. The allowance of the ADMW for these foreign exchange students is likely the only thing keeping at least 3 out of the 5 schools open. And the reason for this request today is House Bill 3359 passed through the House without any opposition, got over to the Senate side, stalled, and I was told that we do have a hearing on the 26th, but it would only move with a sunset in it, and these schools can't afford a sunset. They need to continue operating indefinitely. I don't think we can tell our kids in these small, small rural schools that you may have 2 years left. So that's the request.
Okay. Any questions? Yeah, Representative Wingert.
I just wanted to point out for the committee's sake, because this came out of House Education, that it passed unanimously out of the House Education Committee, and it passed unanimously on the House floor.
Representative Barnhart.
I have 2 questions, if I might. Did I understand you correctly that the Senate wanted to add a sunset in the other bill? And if so, what was it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the bill was not going to get a hearing to start out with, and then I was told 3 hours ago that it had been released for a hearing on the 26th, but there would be an amendment to 3359 that would put a two-year sunset on it. The reason given for that was so that we would figure out a different funding formula for these small rural schools, something, Representative, that you and I have talked about in the past about revisiting the funding formula for all of our schools and students. Will that happen in 2 years? I'm more than happy to participate in that dialogue, but I think for these five small schools, we're dealing with 46 total students. The bill also caps this method of funding to the five schools and those 46 students maximum.
Mr. Chair, the other topic that I wanted to raise, in the conversation about this amendment, I got the impression that this would increase ADMW by more than one per each student. Is that true, or is it simply increase it by one? Let me try it again, if I could. Absent this bill, these students may not qualify as students at all, and therefore their weighted number would be zero.
Mr. Chair,
we wouldn't count them at all.
That's correct.
If this amendment is approved and goes through the process, then will we count them as a single student, or will we count them as more than a single student for the purposes of the ADMW?
Mr. Chair, would it be okay for us to ask Jim Green to come forward and maybe be a little more specific to that?
That's the answer.
Not necessarily.
Let's get it right.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon Small Schools Association, Representative Barnhart, they would generate a single ADMW weight. And the only difference is they're in a dorm. If a student is a foreign exchange student and lives with my wife and I here in the Salem-Keizer School District, they would count in the state school fund formula. The only difference is these five school districts have a dorm, not just for foreign exchange students, but for other resident students of their district because the distances they have to travel to go to school.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question.
Anybody else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Freeman.
I want to thank Representative Huffman for bringing this amendment forward. It seems like the appropriate place for it. And I would move, Mr. Co-Chair, the Dash 2 amendments dated 5-17-11 to Senate Bill 800.
Representative Freeman moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 800 dated 5-17-11. Is there any discussion? Seeing none.
Amy, Mr. Chair, could we possibly stand at ease for a moment?
Good. Okay, sure.
That'd be all right.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We're going to take a